everybody, on this beautiful, beautiful Friday morning here in Baltimore. Glad you're with us. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Mark Hyman joins me in the studio. He is our resident sports guru. And we're going to talk a little baseball, a little football, or at least a little football with a little bit of air in them. God knows how much air. And we got all sorts of stuff to talk about in the world of sports. This morning, Mark is on the faculty of the George Washington University, the author of several books, the latest of which is called Concussions and Our Kids. Good morning, sir.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing okay. You know, perhaps it's a sign of, you know, some getting back to normalcy here in our city after such a tumultuous time that we are talking about sports and the Maryland Film Festival is underway. People are going to that. There are certain things about our city we don't want to have return to normal, like people's neglect of the West Side in particular. But it's a good idea that I think perhaps we can move on and talk about some things that are on people's minds in the world of sports. Deflategate is the big story of this week. Tom Brady and the New England Patriots accused of deflating footballs in the AFC Championship game last season. Refresh our memories here about the facts as we know them in this case.
What an amazing story. I mean, just couldn't make this up. So in the AFC Championship game last year, the Colts were playing the Patriots, and the Colts complained about the fact that some of the footballs seemed to be underinflated. And this resulted in an investigation that was really looking at whether the Patriots were attempting to get some kind of advantage by, you know, putting these underinflated balls into play. So,
and the reason, by the way, that there's an advantage is that it's cold and you can grip the ball, you can squeeze it a little tighter if it's not fully inflated.
Yeah, it's easier to throw if it's underinflated. So this investigation was ongoing for several months. The report was made public yesterday or the day before, and it concluded that more likely, certainly that the balls were underinflated, and that the Patriots, several lower-level Patriot employees were responsible for letting the air out of the balls. And importantly, more likely than not, Tom Brady, the iconic quarterback of the Patriots, knew about it and was part of this effort to gain this advantage.
You know, if they're really worried about this, why is it that each team has its own set of footballs that they use in the game? Why isn't there just a common set of footballs that the refs or somebody else oversees? I mean, this seems like an easy fix.
Well, there will be. Next year, there will be a very different protocol for sure, because this is ridiculous. That this kind of thing, there should be a chain of command, a chain of where the footballs are going, that don't allow this to happen. It's just totally unnecessary. As you point out, it's a very easy fix.
Yeah, there's actually videotape of one of the trainers or one of the people on the staff of the New England Patriots going into a restroom for about 2 minutes with a large bag of footballs. Now, most of the time when I go to the restroom, I don't take a bag of footballs in there. It's a little unusual. And, of course, the Colts, who they were playing, the Patriots were playing, had their own set of footballs. They were not and they were using theirs, and the Patriots were using their own set. So I guess the question is, did Tom Brady, the quarterback, did Coach Bill Belichick, did they know about this? And the reports that's just come out this week is a little, it's fairly damning to Mr. Brady, but they don't say conclusively, yes, absolutely, we know that he knew.
Yeah, I mean, one important point is to note that this is not a criminal offense. You know, we're not talking about a legal proceeding. This is just the enforcement of a league rule. And so, for instance, Tom Brady could not be compelled to turn over his cell phone and give the investigators access to his texts. And in fact, he elected not to do that. So as a result, there are some holes, and we don't have all of the evidence that would be necessary to conclude without question that Tom Brady was complicit in this, that he knew about it, But the circumstantial evidence is I think, pretty compelling.
And we should say that he's, you know, been on the record several times saying, I knew nothing about it. This is all news to me.
Yeah, you know? Although last night he appeared at Salem State University in Massachusetts for a planned event, you know, long before the release of this was scheduled for yesterday or the day before. And he said that he wanted more time to think about what his response would be. So at this point, he is not as assertive in denying that he was aware of this.
And, of course, cheating of this, and I think that's really all we can call it, is cheating. This is just,
I would agree with that,
fooling
Tom.
With the rules here. Cheating is not necessarily brand new to the NFL. I mean, just last season, there were a couple of somewhat celebrated events of other teams doing other kinds of things.
That's right. And I think it's important to put this in context. You know, what Tom Brady is probably the biggest star in football. We all know about Tom Brady. He's probably the most, other than the two of us, the most handsome man on earth. He's married to a supermodel.
People magazine often rates the three of us 1, 2, 3. But he's first.
And I'm fine to be three. So this, that just adds fuel to the story. There are lots of people who are not football fans who know who Tom Brady is. So it's different in that respect. But you're right. Cheating at football is not unique. It's not even unusual.
My favorite is the Atlanta Falcons last year. They had a unique and novel way of cooking the books for the game.
Yeah. Now get this. I mean, you know, some football fans will remember this. Last year, the Falcons, to gain an advantage, they were piping in crowd noise into the stadium to disrupt the quarterback of the opposing team so that the quarterback couldn't communicate as easily with his players. And they got caught for doing that, and they were penalized. In March, the commissioner levied a penalty against them. They lost a fifth-round draft choice in 2016, and they were fined $350,000 for doing that.
Mm-hmm. Cleveland Browns also had an incident involving their general manager texting the coaches on the sidelines from the press box.
Ray Farmer, the general manager of the Browns, was caught communicating with the coaches during the game, which you're not permitted to do, and he was fined $250,000 and suspended, I believe, for several games. So the team, they didn't lose a draft choice, but the league has a history of responding to instances in which the rules are broken or ignored in some way. So there will be some response to this, for sure. It's just a question of what.
Roger Goodell, the commissioner, is it in his prerogative, his discretion to decide what the penalty should be? There are a lot of people calling for Tom Brady to be suspended for as many as six games, half the season or so.
Yeah, it's Roger Goodell's call, and he has, you know, a number of options available to him. There could be a fine that would be levied against the team. There could be the forfeiture of draft choices in the next draft, the 2016 draft. And by the way, some people, you know, are theorizing that the timing of the release of the report was several days after the 2015 draft, because the penalty will include draft choices in the 2016 draft, and that just makes it a little bit clearer. So that's another possibility. And, of course, there is the loss of, you know, Brady may have to sit out some games. If you're going to ask me, I would say, you know, 4 to 6 games would be an appropriate penalty.
I mean, and you'd think that a suspension from games would be a lot more severe a penalty in Mr. Brady's mind than a financial penalty. He's got a lot of money.
No doubt. I mean, you can fine Tom Brady $2 million. I don't think that's going to affect his lifestyle.
On 81, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Mark Hyman is our sports guru. He joins me here in Studio A. We're talking sports this morning, at a variety of ancillary and related topics. So the brand guys, the folks who hire these athletes to endorse their brands, have been going back and forth. There's an interesting piece in Adweek magazine this week where half of the people they interviewed said that this won't have any effect on Mr. Brady's ability to sell products, and others say, oh, he's done. Brady and his wife, the model Gisele Bündchen, they are major Under Armour endorsers. What is this going to do for Under Armour? Does Under Armour have to worry now that they've got damaged goods wearing their T-shirts?
You know, Brady's an interesting case in that, you know, again, he transcends sports. He really is, he's as much a male model in some ways as he is a sports figure. And he's got deals. He has a deal with Under Armour, of course. He's got a deal with Uggs, that the boots, and I see you're wearing your Uggs today, Tom.
Always.
And Movado as well. So he's got, you know, a stable of endorsement deals that are very lucrative. His deal with Under Armour is very unusual in this respect. In addition to, you know, whatever they pay him to represent the brand, he also has an equity stake in the company.
Which these days has been a pretty good deal because the equity of, you know, the value of that company has continued to skyrocket.
Yeah, I think that was very shrewd on his part. And it gives you a sense both of how eager Under Armour was to have him as an endorser and how confident, how the confidence that he has in the company. So it'll be interesting to see how Under Armour addresses this, if they address it at all. That they're pretty good at crisis management. Now, it's a very different case, but remember the Winter Olympics several years ago when there was this flap about the speed skating uniforms that Under Armour had provided to the U.S. team. Under Armour...
And the team, you know, promptly lost virtually every round.
They did very poorly, but Under Armour got ahead of that very quickly. They quickly extended their deal with the speed skating team, which gave everyone a level of confidence that it wasn't really the uniforms. And Kevin Plank was very visible and doing media interviews. So they handled that very well. That's a very different case than what we're talking about here. But it'd be interesting to see how they manage this. But Under Armour has done a great job with their commercial the endorsers that they choose. Jordan Spieth, who just won the Masters, they signed a couple of years ago, and Steph Curry, the recently named MVP of the National Basketball Association, also an Under Armour spokesman. So they've got a very good record of choosing their talent.
Yeah, they're choosing deep and early. Jordan Spieth, I'm not a big golf fan. I'm a casual observer of golf. And like most casual observers, I tuned into the last round of the Masters a little bit. And there's Mr. Spieth, who I think is 11 years old. the Under Armour. I mean, I noticed how huge that Under Armour logo on his hat.
Well, here's an interesting...
And his shirt and his pants and his golf bag and everything.
Well, you weren't watching that closely if he appeared to be 11 to you, because he's actually 13. No, I think he's 21.
Yeah. Almost tied or something for the youngest winner of the Masters, Tiger Woods.
Yeah, with
won
Tiger.
Within months of his 21st birthday.
Under Armour has a deal with him where he's not allowed to wear any other corporate logo on his person until, I think, 2025. So that's an incredible deal for Under Armour.
Yeah, good for them. Let's talk about the Orioles. They lost the game to the Yankees last night, as Nathan has been reporting this morning. They're in fifth place in the AL East. J.J. Hardy joined the lineup last night, so that's good news. Matt Wieters is still on the disabled list. He's still doing rehab in the minor leagues. How important is the return of Mr. Hardy going to be, and how important is the return of Matt Wieters? Because his replacement is doing a pretty good job.
Well, I know Buck Showalter is happy to have J.J. Hardy back. I remember in spring training when Hardy initially injured his left shoulder, his non-throwing shoulder, and Buck was saying he'd be back in something like 10 days, and it's turned out to be 6 or 8 weeks.
Yeah, 25 games.
So he's a very important piece, and they're better with J.J. Hardy on the field than, you know, Everett Cabrera, his replacement, played well, but no question that they're better with Hardy at short. Wieters raises an interesting question in that, you know, Matt Wieters had Tommy John surgery last year. He's been out now for about a year.
It's a surgery on his elbow, and this is his last year in his contract. He's going to become a free agent. To sign him putatively, they'd have to spend a lot of money to get him back. Maybe that's not such a good investment these days.
Yeah, before his injury, I think everyone assumed that he was one of the best catchers in baseball and that he would command a major, major salary. The surprise is that his replacement has played extremely well. Caleb Joseph, who has been catching for the Orioles pretty much for the last year, is hitting 300, has 3 or 4 home runs, and, you know, is more than just, you know, a placeholder for Matt Wieters. What will the Orioles do? Will they make a big effort to re-sign Matt Wieters?
Let's talk about the Orioles and the economic hit that they took last week during the curfew week. One of the games they played at Camden Yards was played without an audience, nobody in the stands. Then they moved some games that were supposed to be home games to Florida. How did that arrangement work? And what's your guess? You cover the business of sports. What's your guess as to how much they lost? And it is a substantial amount? I mean, we know that the folks who work for the Orioles, I mean, we feel our hearts go out to the vendors, you know, who couldn't work those games, you know, the people in the businesses surrounding Camden Yards. But for the Orioles themselves.
What happened, you know, that game in which there were no spectators, that's unprecedented. That had never happened in the history of Major League Baseball. And then there were three games that were played but were moved to St. Petersburg against the Tampa Bay Rays. So the Orioles were the home team, but they were playing in St. Petersburg. The Orioles got all ticket receipts, all the revenue generated by ticket sales for those three games in St. Petersburg, and the concession revenues. That went to the Orioles. But
they were averaging about 33,000 folks in games at Camden Yards. They got many fewer than that in games at the Trop.
That's right. I would say, you know, ballpark, no pun intended, the Orioles probably took a $1 million hit as a result of all of this kind of dislocation and the changes that needed to be made, which is a significant amount of money. It's a $1 billion business. So, it is nothing that the Orioles can't weather.
Yeah, a $1 million hit to the Orioles, much less severe than the hit that each of those vendors took the days that they couldn't
work.
No
question. And also the businesses around Camden Yards, which rely on those 81 dates for, a lot of their revenue.
Yeah. All right. Well, Mark Hyman, always good to see you. Thank you so much. And enjoy the film festival this weekend and the other things you have on your docket. Appreciate you coming by. Mark Hyman, he's on the faculty of George Washington University. His latest book is called Concussions and Our Kids. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead. Stick around.